This is Taking Aim with
Roshan Men
and Maya Schoen, and we're continuing today with our May month of special programming. Today we're going to have a call-in show based upon the series we did about Bear Stearns and the demise, the collapse of capitalism, and particularly the rampant speculation throughout the world. The number to call at WBAI is 212-209-2900. I'd like to say at the beginning of the program that during our May month of special programming, during the WBAI Fund Drive, we're going to be on next Tuesday for 2 hours. The first hour will follow Democracy Now! From 11 to 12. And for those of you on the West Coast, that's from 8 to 9 in the morning. So tune in for a special programming. And then at our regular slot, the 5 to 6 drive time, we'll again be on for another hour. So stay tuned for next Tuesday for 2 hours of Taking Aim, first in the morning and then in at our regular time in the afternoon. Today we're going to kick off our programming with some comments about global hunger, something that many of us have been thinking about lately, and particularly the United Nations. On Tuesday, April 22nd, a UN spokesperson referred to a silent tsunami that threatens to plunge more than 100 million people on every continent into hunger. Josette Sheeran, who's the executive director of the UN World Food Program, noted, quote, "This is the new face of hunger. The millions of people who were not in the urgent hunger category 6 months ago, but are now. Consider this. 2.8 billion people, that's almost half the world's population, live on less than $2 a day. And as the new statesman noted, you may pay for the profits of the big agribusiness with your life. That is what is happening. Even the capitalist media, the bourgeois media, is discussing this. As a recent article in the British New Statesman magazine was written, it was entitled, The Trading Frenzy That Sent Prices Soaring. Trading frenzy? That's not what you think of when you think of hunger. You usually think of drought. You think of environmental factors that create situations where the crops fail. But in fact, what is happening now is that the long-term factors are important, long-term factors such as global warming, but he notes in his article that the real reasons why food prices have doubled, or why India is rationing rice, or why British farmers are killing pigs for which they can't afford feedstocks, happens to be the speculation that is going on in the commodities markets. World prices for basic commodities such as cereal, cooking oil, and milk have risen steadily since 2000. But there has been a vast increase in an incredibly short space of time that is essentially over the past 18 months. Over the past 18 months, as we saw the speculative derivatives market collapse, which was based on the funny money attempts to set up derivatives and other financial speculative instruments based upon the housing mortgage market, the bonds. And this has now plowed the investors into food and raw materials as they saw their investments in the mortgage bonds collapse. What are they doing? They're creating starvation on an epic scale. And this is what is now discussed in the financial newspapers throughout the world. Ralph?
Yes, Maya. Well, speculation is at the heart of the capitalist order. And at least for 75 to 80 years now, productive forces in the world of economy of where real people have to survive have been in rapid decline because the capitalists are not investing in production. They are investing in paper shuffling and in speculation. Nowhere has this been more clearly elucidated than in Der Spiegel on April 23rd, in its article, The Role of Speculators in the Global Food Crisis, by Beit Bazile and Frank Hornig. Vast amounts of money are flooding the world's commodities markets, driving up prices for staple foods like wheat and rice. Biofuels and droughts cannot explain the recent food crisis. It is hedge funds and investors that bear responsibility for global hunger, states Der Spiegel. Not long ago, Dwight Anderson welcomed reporters with open arms. He would entertain them with the stories from the world of big money. Anderson is the New York hedge fund manager As recently as last October, he was stumping Malaysia to talk with enthusiasm about his Malaysian palm oil plantations and his Brazilian grain farms. You can clearly see how supply is getting tight, he said with great enthusiasm. In mid-2006, Anderson was touting, quote, the extraordinary profitability of field crops from corn to soybeans. He was convinced that the rising worldwide hunger is synonymous with hugely profitable and, as he put it, dead certain investment bargain. Now, what we're looking at here as the articles in Der Spiegel and the New Statesman and in the various mainstream financial publications elucidate is a focused, concentrated shift into commodities from housing, from hedge fund derivatives into speculation on food. Agricultural corporations boast huge profits in the midst of the food crisis. As inflation and shortages expose billions to worldwide hunger, agricultural giant Archer Daniels Midland revealed a 42% leap in short-term quarterly profit. The announcement followed skyrocketing earnings reports from a dozen other agricultural business, and notably from the major oil companies BP, Shell, and Exxon. Quote, and this is from the Archer Daniel Midland's chief executive, Patricia Wirtz. Volatility in the commodity markets has presented us with unprecedented opportunities. Once again, our team has leveraged financial flexibility in our global asset base to capture these opportunities to deliver shareholder value. Translation, mass hunger, mass starvation, death on a vast scale.
I think this is a good point to interject the relationship between these huge agribusiness companies such as Archer Daniels Midland with its 42% leap in quarterly profits and their relationship with the political instrument, the presidents of this United States. Because Archer Daniels Midland was one of the major contributors to Bill Clinton during his race to the presidency and his eventual winning and becoming president for two terms. And it was a result of the relationship and the significance of Archer Daniels Midland's contribution that the shift to corn and the corn derivative as part of the gasoline process as an additive, supposedly a clean oil additive. And that's when it took place. It started as in a small aspect with the relationship of Clinton to Archer Daniels Midland Company, and now it has become the basis of the big drive for biofuel throughout the world as an alternative to oil. And it turns out it's a really environmentally hazardous alternative to oil because the amount of fuel that goes into the tractors and the elimination of the corn in the food chain is devastating throughout the world. And this is something that the United Nations in particular, which studies the growth of hunger throughout the world, has been discussing. Ralph?
Yes. Brothers and sisters, Newsweek magazine has published an important article in which they make clear, and this is on April 25th, why higher gas prices make economic sense by Keith Naughton. You will be paying $6 per gallon. As gas prices hit new records and John McCain struck a populist chord with a proposal for gas tax holiday, it became very clear that the gas prices are a reflection of deliberate policy. The biggest lie in American politics, the article states, is to say you care deeply about global warming and advocate for the price of gas to go down. They are mutually exclusive concepts. The fact of the matter is that gas prices at $6 has long been on the drawing board and is probably an understatement. It is anticipated that within 1 year, the price of crude oil will be not $120 a barrel, but over $200 a barrel and heading for $250.
And, Ralph, when you talk about $6 gallon for gasoline, you're talking about vast increases in the price of food because it is gasoline that is used in all those tractors and also the oil products that eventually find their way into fertilizer.
So what we have to look at, Maya, in relation to the question of commodities such as crude oil and of food staples, and we were mentioning Archer Daniel Midlands, and we shouldn't forget Cargill, is that these vast food conglomerates have had as their central policy, guided by Wall Street and guided by the big financial houses that have been recently in crisis, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, all of them. They have been engaged in doing something very specific, namely in imposing upon the poor of the world commodity crops, as opposed to being food self-sufficient, growing food that can be consumed, be it rice, be it corn, be it a variety of foodstuffs. They grow instead commodities, tea and coffee and sisal and sugar, which can be traded on a commodities market, which then leaves the food monopoly in the hands of these conglomerates. So the very peoples who had formerly been producing the food and were food self-sufficient throughout Africa, throughout India, throughout the Middle East, throughout Asia, rice food self-sufficient, wheat food self-sufficient, all variety of tubers food self-sufficient, from cassava to potato, these are no longer in existence because those lands have been grabbed up and have been the arena for cheap labor producing commodities for a trading market.
Well, that's Ralph, the big example of that is Haiti, which was a food exporter and now is a major food importer from the United States of rice. And Haiti, the poorest nation in the entire Americas. And we have also the transfer of tracts of land across the planet being switched from food crops as a result to the production of ethanol or other biofuel, because they also make biofuels from sugar. And this is aimed as the supplement to oil-based gasoline, the myth that there isn't enough oil throughout the world to supply for the production of gasoline. Next year, the U.S. corn crop that's going to be used for ethanol is forecast to rise to 114 million tons, and this is nearly one-third of the entire projected U.S. corn crop. And remember, corn, not only for human consumption, corn is the primary basis for animal feed. Not that we promote, as you know, we speak often about the importance of a vegetarian diet and the rampant dysfunction of using land for corn for feeding animals, not only the ethical problem, the torture of other species, but the fact that this is an terribly inefficient use of the resources of the world.
Well, it pollutes the planet and it deprives it of the ability to provide food stocks that could be enable people to be food self-sufficient. But the commodity speculation has spread long ago from standard products like oil and gold to anything edible and available for trade on the Chicago Futures Exchange. The Spiegel was pointing out that there are future contracts now on everything from wheat to oranges to pork bellies. The futures market is a traditional tool, and the futures contract quantities and prices and delivery dates are fixed even before the crops have been planted. And what this in essence is allowing is a vast speculation on the driving up of prices. To concretize this, the wheat price per bushel has risen 64%. Corn is up 68%, soybeans 76%, rice has risen by 134%, and in addition to this speculation, Archer Daniel Midland CEO Wirtz reveals that the enormous prices for staple grains have been attended by a deliberate policy of the corporations at every stage along the production and supply lines, as well as on the trade floors. So amidst the severe global grain shortfall, there is an inflationary surge. And that's what is fueling the sevenfold increase in profit for Archer Daniel Midlands. These are the speculators in mass death. It's a genocidal rooting of capitalism in the most calculated plan to drive vast masses of people, literally billions of people, into starvation mode. You mentioned Haiti, Maya. The uprising of the Haitian masses and produced a general strike that gave rise to the first presidential campaign of Aristide. The human rights pretender Jimmy Carter quickly went to Aristide to say, "We'll keep the troops in the barracks if you impose the austerity measures of the International Monetary Fund. You do that or the election won't occur." Aristide came into office and implemented the most severe austerity measures of the International Monetary Fund on record. And the fruit of that politics are borne out now in the food riots across Haiti, the starvation of which Haiti is a central example, which is proliferating from Haiti all of the East African and West African littoral, with the rampant Cargill and Archer Daniel Midland speculation with enormous profit increases in the shorting out of the availability of food supplies and the vast increase in their cost.
Ralph, I'd like to repeat the number to call, 212-209-2900. We're opening the phone lines today. I also want to mention, you probably have guessed, Ralph and I are in different locations here, and we recently returned from back east, and where we had a wonderful rally, and we want to thank all of you who attended the New York 9/11 Truth Movement rally for the petition drive to get on the New York ballot an initiative to have a real citizens' investigation of the events of 9/11. And if you haven't picked up a petition, you can go to ny911truth.org and pull down a petition, sign it, and get your friends and your neighbors and everyone you know to sign it. We must get thousands and thousands of signatures within the next few weeks in order to get this initiative on the ballot. Once it's on the ballot, we know people will make that vote, the proper vote, because a real investigation is essential. The events of 9/11, as you've heard us discuss over and over again, this was an inside job. This was not this was an act of terror, but it was an act of terror by the U.S. government on the people of the world. So please check out the ny911truth.org, pull down your petition, and contact the people so that you too can be a volunteer and join all the people who are collecting signatures. Again, the phone number to call to reach us today is 212-209-2900. We welcome your comments and, most importantly, your questions. This is an opportunity to ask the questions that you've been thinking about our series, about Bear Stearns, about the results of speculation here in the United States. And also, I want to remind you that next week we're going to be on 2 hours from 11 to 12 and again from 5 to 6 discussing the events of the aspects of speculation, the significance to each and every one of us, and how we can organize, what we can do to create a life in our own interest. Ralph, Michael, do we have people on the line? Okay, let's. Oh, you're online, WBAI.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, how are you? Thanks for calling.
I'd just like to make two comments and then ask you a general question. I hope you can answer in a later program. But I'd just like to make the point that I think that what we're witnessing now is a de facto nationalization of a lot of the bank debt, which were incurred, namely through the derivative market. And that is what is helping to fuel the stock market now. The other point I'd like to make is that although I agree with you about all the problems that the poor are facing, especially in these underdeveloped countries, there's going to be a backlash. And I think that poor people are going to, agricultural policies are going to have to change in many of these countries. Otherwise, the poor are going to riot. And there's going to be a tremendous amount of social upheaval. The question that I'd love to ask you, though, which I hope you can answer in a future program, is whether or not you think the Palestinian people have any hope at all to recover their land, and whether or not you think that the nation of Israel will survive. I'll take that question, the answer for that, at another date. Thank you.
You try to address a couple of the points that you make. First of all, bank speculation, which is a constant in finance capital, is always about shuffling paper, speculating upon it, and it's a deeply, deeply unstable system because it's based upon virtually nothing. We discussed in our prior programs how you would have as little as 2 cents on the dollar as a capital base for these speculations when they hedge and leverage their paper investments. Now that this comes a cropper and they're asking the populations to bail them out, they're shifting to commodities. And I started off by discussing this fellow Anderson, the New York hedge fund manager, who spoke with such enthusiasm about his speculations in Malaysian palm oil. I'm constantly wired, he used to say. His nickname in the industry is the commodities king. His Osprey hedge fund is the world's largest. Now, what are they speculating in? They're speculating in foodstuff. So the comment that you make about how the populations in these countries are going to have to change their policies with reference to food somewhat misses the point. The people in question, the masses of the population in Africa, Asia, Latin America, in fact, for that matter, in North America, have absolutely no control over what are the policies with regard to food, because food is monopolized by these vast conglomerates and deployed as a commodity on which to speculate. And the land that is available is not used for foodstuffs, but for commodities, again, for which speculation can be escalated. According to the United Nations, now, North Korea is on the brink of humanitarian crisis. Egypt, Uzbekistan, Bangladesh, South Africa, Haiti, it is an epidemic of mass hunger that is on the agenda. The planet's grain reserves are empty. It's nothing to do with global population growth. It has nothing to do with the putative industrialization of other countries. It is because of the calculated speculation on commodities markets to do with food. Food is destroyed. Food is contained. Food is held up. There are future contracts on everything from wheat to oranges to pork bellies. That is the root of the mass immiseration. And you talk about the prospect of food riots, which are in fact unfolding across the planet. Food riots are only the little beginning. This is what Trotsky called in the history of the Russian Revolution a period when the masses are sorting things out. The full magnitude of the crime that is being visited upon them is being felt, and people are sorting it out. They are coming to the rapid conclusion that the financial speculators offer them nothing but mass hunger, global hunger, starvation, and they are sorting out what is to be done.
Ralph,
that sorting out will lead to an explosion of revolutionary upsurge of mass struggle that will dwarf those struggles of the beginning of the 20th century.
And in terms of strategy and revolutionary struggle, I'd like to point out that the last chapter of The Hidden History of Zionism is a strategy for revolution, and on the issue of the Palestinian struggle, I suggest you look at it. It's available in book form, which you can order from us or through Amazon.com, and also it's on the website at our website, www.takingaimradio.com, and we have many programs on the Palestinian struggle on our website also. Let's go to the next caller, 212-209-2900, and for Taking Aim for a discussion with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Michael, next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Maya. So I'm calling. I have a question that I haven't heard anybody address, and I'm not sure if you know the answer or not. But are U.S. farmers still being subsidized to not grow crops?
I'm sorry, what was that question?
The question has to do with crop subsidies. And, in fact, U.S. farmers receive subsidies. Some of it is to not grow crops, and some is for the storage of crops. But lately, the storehouses are empty. And there is a large subsidy for sugar growers. There are the farm bill. This was the big discussion in the agricultural bill recently passed, which was the subsidization of farmers, big farmers. For a long time, farmers received subsidies not to grow tobacco, and instead they just let their land grow fallow. So that still goes on. A lot of that is patronage. Rather than boosting farmers. The days of the family farmers are long gone. Most farming is large agribusiness.
Yeah, factory farms and so on. Yeah, it just seems ironic that, you know, there's bunches of people starving and there's, you know, farmers being paid to let their land go fallow.
Well, it has
to do with price support.
Well, the price support, however, is the concession made for a larger purpose, which is to keep the price of commodities high, notably foodstuffs. And the protectionism is a sop to farmers, but the main engine of farming in the United States are the food conglomerates, the vast corporate farms. Small farms are a vanishingly little percentage of the production of foodstuffs in the country. It has been conglomeratized, it has been monopolized, it has been centered in these great monopolies, oligopolies like Cargill and Archer Daniel Midlands.
And that was one of the results of NAFTA, was with the elimination from the Mexican Constitution of the ejidos, the collective land, and allowing foreign companies to go into Mexico. You had Pillsbury and, you know, the Jolly Green Giant line going in and buying up lots of land and creating vast factory farming, and you even have in Mexico the problems of corn right now. Corn, the staple of the Mexican food system, and the fact of competition with foreign agribusiness eliminating the indigenous corn, and also the indigenous corn seed, and this is a big subject for another time when you deal with the role of Monsanto and the hybrid corns, the chemical seed crops, and the control of the seed crops by patenting them,
right,
so
the
that
genetically
people can.
This is
a very big subject and a very important political subject that we hope to address sometime, but that other programmers on WBAI have addressed over the years.
Mm-hmm. I want to emphasize that the issue of genetic modification is a subset of the problem, because this corn that we're discussing now is being altered from a food supply to a substitute energy vehicle, namely that of ethanol. And so it is tied to the energy commodities market and the speculation that attends that, and it is taken out of the food chain. It's not for tortillas that the food is being grown. It is not as a source of sustenance that the food is being grown, but as a commodity servicing energy and keyed to the oil industry itself. The World Bank has taken note of the fact, as Der Spiegel wrote about on April 10th, that chaos is spreading as the food prices skyrocket. That's the headline in Der Spiegel. Gunfire in Haiti, riots in Cameroon, a government crisis in the Philippines, the effects of skyrocketing food prices are reaching every corner of the world. The World Bank has called on world leaders to take action before it is too late. The action that they are talking about is repression. And then the article in the Der Spiegel continues. The scenes in Haiti are dramatic. Gunfire on streets across the capital of Port-au-Prince. Tens of thousands parading in the streets. Thousands of UN's peacekeepers, so-called, powerless to stop the violence and the widespread looting. People killed across the city. Even an impassioned plea by the Caribbean country's President René Préval has failed to restore order. Haitians are reacting to problems that cannot be wished away. Food crises across the globe are skyrocketing. Rice prices in Asia, the price of bread in Egypt, the milk products in Europe, and the pasta in Italy. The result is unrest on a scale not seen in a very long time. Many more concerned that a mass uprising is but a price hike away. That's the language of Der Spiegel. The World Bank President Robert Zoellick has called on world leaders to act in response to the global food crisis. He's addressed the United States, the European Union, Japan, and the other developed countries to address the fact that, quote, many more people will suffer and starve.
We're going to pause now for station identification.
This is Phil Donahue. I have 600 channels in my home, but 400 of them are selling the Bowflex machine. That's why I listen to WBAI New York.
This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We're having a special call-in program today. We've been discussing in particular speculation on food products, the increased global hunger, as the United Nations spokesperson referred to a silent tsunami that threatens to plunge more than 100 million people on every continent into hunger. This is Josette Sharon, who's the executive director of the UN World Food Program, the WFP. She has noted that millions of people who were not in the urgent hunger category 6 months ago now are. They are. And among the 100 million people on every continent who are being recently plunged into hunger, you have to understand that 2.8 billion people, that's almost half the world's population, live on less than $2 a day. $2 a day. The number to call is 212-209-2900. I'm sure that many people are on the line and waiting to... Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, brother.
Hi, Ralph. Hi, Maya. I've been lucky enough to be able to call in almost every time you take phone calls.
Terrific.
This is a bit off topic, but I'd like to get your astute opinion on the situation in Zimbabwe and Mr. Mugabe. I did support Mr. Mugabe during his anti-colonial struggle against the apartheid state of Rhodesia, but I no longer support him. And I'd like to get your take on that situation, and I'll take your answer off the air.
There are a number of important things to say. Of course, Robert Mugabe was... Hello? Yes,
okay.
Robert Mugabe was a central figure in the struggle for national independence in Zimbabwe, as was Joshua Nkomo. But let it be said that when Mugabe took office in Zimbabwe, he imposed the IMF and World Bank austerity plans in Zimbabwe for a very long time. And indeed, Robert Mugabe, with the rhetoric of nationalism, did not address the question of imperial control of the economy. When his policies resulted in a large percentage of hunger, unemployment, and immiseration, he began to adopt the rhetoric of distributing land, because after all, as in South Africa, so in Zimbabwe, the question of land had not been addressed by the anti-colonial revolution, not been addressed in the sense that land was left in the hands of the settlers. the productive lands were not nationalized. They were not distributed to amongst the population. The farmers and the poor, the peasants of Zimbabwe, did not inherit the land that was theirs. It was not made available as cooperative land. It was not made available as land under the production of those who work it. It was left in the hands of colonial settlers who have a feudal and colonial structure in relation to work on the land. Now, the problem, indeed, is at root in the attempt to address this question is that it cannot be done with rhetoric and with bureaucratic measures from above. It requires mobilizing the peasants to create movements of land occupation and call for land to be under the control of those who produce on it.
And, Ralph, also the political process.
Is that of empowering the population in a democratic fashion and with workers' councils, with workers' control. So it is a bureaucratic approach that Zimbabwe's under Mugabe has taken to the crisis that is the result of the national bourgeoisie's own limited policies. The policies that the Cuban Revolution attempted to address from its inception, leaving aside issues of bureaucratization or of autocracy in Cuba as in Zimbabwe, the core question is the empowerment of the masses under their own political control, and that has a profoundly democratic content. It cannot be done with a police state, it cannot be done with a bureaucracy, and it cannot be done by paying lip service to these ideas while implementing the policies of world imperialism. Because all that they will do when you attempt to then challenge them, as they are doing with Zimbabwe, is starving Zimbabwe out, deepening the crisis facing the regime, and the regime has shown itself incapable of addressing that crisis because the population is not engaged in as the active force in addressing the land question, the question of national ownership, the question of social ownership. It is a socialist question that is confronting the people of Zimbabwe as it does the masses of Africa at large.
Okay, now we'll go on to our next 2209-2900. You're on the air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Taking Aim.
Thank you. I'd like to raise the issue of this supposed split between a political model and a parapolitical model of what's going on in the world and raise the question about what the implications are for action that we can do now.
Could you please explain what you mean by the political model and the...
Yeah, I mean, basically, some people pose that an institutional model of society, an institutional analysis, is somehow different or opposed to an analysis of conspiracies, covert operations, and the like. My view is that they're very much complementary and they're really relevant. However, I have seen that some people can take a conspiratorial analysis and use it to support just individually opting out from the system or not doing anything. And I'd like to sort of bring it back to, I think we can learn from these sort of tricks that the system uses in terms of suppressing movements and managing societies to be more effective in creating deep institutional change.
Okay, well, thank you for your comments.
Yes,
that's a question
that is often raised in what passes for the left. The academic left is forever buying into the category of conspiracy, particularly when they want to avoid looking at the systemic nature of the crisis facing our society and how events such as September 11th are a reflection of the crisis of capitalism and the constant resort of the rulers when they want to terrorize our population. Let me just try to address this supposed conflict between the notion of institutional responsibility for the crisis of society and the nominal role of conspiracy. Every major arena of judicial discourse in the United States, whether it's the local city judiciary or its county or state or federal, uses the category of conspiracy. Conspiracy to defraud, conspiracy to do this, conspiracy to do that. Every district attorney and every prosecutor is forever invoking the category of conspiracy. Conspiracy, after all, is just two people consorting to do commit a common action in common, in consort. So the issue of conspiracy is a false issue. It's a label with which to dismiss ideas without having to think about them. In terms of how power is structured in our society, it's pretty obvious, is it not, how when the New York Times and the Department of Commerce tell us that 1% of the population own more than 95% of the rest of us combined, that it is a vast concentration of power. And this functioning of this oligarchy, this ruling class, is by definition conspiratorial in nature. When they want to wage a war for oil, do they declare it? When they want to seize the resources of other people, do they acknowledge it? When they want to exploit the population and to increase prices of commodities on which they profit, do they admit it? Of course they don't. Capitalism uses the state as its cat's paw. It subsidizes itself at the expense of the population it exploits. It uses the state apparatus as its coercive arm. Power is not structured in a casual way. It's enormously concentrated. It is highly conscious on the part of those who wield it. It may be that the world is not driven by conspiracy, but it is true that our rulers conduct their affairs in a conspiratorial manner. And it is not particularly courageous of those who pass themselves off as socialists or anti-capitalists who fail to acknowledge that it's a criminal ruling class, a ruthless ruling class. It kills people. It commits crimes against people. It conspires to subjugate our population. It carries out vast predations abroad under false flags without acknowledging its real purpose. That's the essence of capitalist rule. So I find this attempt to use the category of conspiracy in order to dismiss the behavior, which is overwhelmingly manifested by evidence, as little more than a form of cowardice. Intellectual, political, and moral cowardice. There's no contradiction between an understanding of how power works and identifying the crimes as conspiracies against the mass of our people.
Okay, thank you for calling, and on to the next caller. You're on the air.
Hi, Ralph. Hi, Maya.
Hi. Welcome to Taking Aim.
Oh, it's a pleasure that you take calls now and then. Ralph, this is Fred from upstate. I had the honor to have a bite to eat with you several times 3 years ago.
Yes.
I'll be very quick. I don't want to go off topic for more than a minute. You had mentioned 9/11 several times. You folks should be aware, the listeners should be aware, that architects and engineers have joined this fight. AE911truth.org. It's Richard Gage who's heading this, and so far he has over 300 architects on board to fight this illegal administration. Just a quick note, he will have several architects with him at MIT on the, I think it's the 15th, 16th, and 17th of this month. And to go into the belly of the beast, I think, is quite commendable.
Right. Well, thanks for doing mentioning that. We've had Richard on for a two-part program. He's a friend. We work closely together.
And also we offered Richard Gage's presentation as a WBAI premium. And thank you for bringing it up. Everyone should go to AE911truth.org. The video is up there. And also the testaments of the engineers and architects who support the 9/11 investigation. Their comments are up there as to why they have become members of the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
And the display of the actual physical evidence, the architectural engineering and physics of the collapse of the Trade Towers, is nowhere so compellingly and amazingly put together as by Richard Gage in his presentation.
And I'm sure he's going to make a dynamic presentation at MIT, and it's going to have reverberations throughout the engineering community. I'm glad that a presentation has been arranged up there. So if you want to repeat the date for people who are listening in the Boston-Cambridge area.
The dates are, as far as Richard said when I spoke to him, was the 15th, 16th, and 17th.
Of May.
And
I assume the information is available on the website?
I believe it is. I'm not online. I prefer not to be. But a quick comment by Richard. He said when he reaches 1,000 architects, they're going to Washington in their suits and ties, and we'll see what happens then.
Terrific. So if you're an engineer or an architect, we hope that you, too, will become a member of the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
Thanks for your time.
Okay, the number to call again is 212-209-2900. Michael, we're ready.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air, WBAI.
It's always good to hear you, and thank you for all your good work. I don't know how you stay alive in this capitalist system. The point is that I remember when Bush was urging people to buy their own homes. How can we have a system of such complexities that such things as monopoly control have not prevailed? I mean, Murdoch keeps buying newspapers. Instead of making one great, he figures competition take them all, you know what I mean? So I wish you'd address this failure of our system to control Bear Stearns' behavior and all these investment and stock things and so forth. Ralph, thank you, and Maya, thank you very much.
Well, the very nature of the capitalist system is to not control Bear Stearns and the other consolidation and concentration of capital. The essence of the political system is to nurture and support those who put people in power, that is the ruling class of this country. So you saw during the Clinton administration the actual overturning of the Glass-Steagall Act, which during the Depression era act that created the separation between investment houses and the banking institutions, where you put your savings. And this was because during the collapse of the financial system, they wanted to make sure that the personal savings and the corporate savings income was separate from speculative investment. However, what you saw with the development of derivatives and hedge funds, which are not controlled by the securities, the SEC, the Securities Administration, what you have then was the banks were saying, we can't make the same profits as these investment houses because what we do is under some element of control. We have to keep a certain amount of money in the bank as security for the amount of money that we can then lend out. And
yes,
also
I
our books can be examined. And what Glass-Steagall did by overturning Glass-Steagall, it allowed the banks to also create these investment off-the-book instruments. And that is the role of a government that is put in power by the ruling class and does not serve the interests of you and me. And that's why we're always talking about the importance of creating a political instrument of our own, of organizing and of overthrowing the system.
I would like to add to that we have to keep in mind that if you remember the Federal Reserve parades as an instrument of state and governmental and national policy. But the Federal Reserve consists of the private banking apparatus of the United States. The Federal Reserve is, in fact, the captains of capital. Bernanke or Greenspan are the instruments of the big financial houses and their speculative policies, and the policies that determine when they print money and what interest rates are permitted here, there, and elsewhere are bank-determined, speculator-determined, because the facade of a public face is just that. It is not a public aspect of policy that we are looking at, but it is the legitimizing of the control by the banks and corporate captains of capital, and the state gives them the color of authority, but it is their instrument. It is their vehicle. They subsidize themselves through it. They mediate their speculative policies by way of it. just to give an illustration that comes back to what we were discussing earlier today, in the Der Spiegel article called The Daily Struggle for Food, it addresses how global food prices are contrived. They are World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and ultimately Federal Reserve determinations that affect speculation in commodities. Now, in the concrete example that is given in Der Spiegel, to take the, this comes back to a call we had at the beginning of the show about the Palestinian people, the Arab masses, and notably those in Egypt, are plunged into a condition of immiseration and starvation. There is barely enough food now in Egypt for 80 million people. It is the most populous country in the Arab world. Food is becoming increasingly scarce. The prices are rising. The people, and I'm quoting, do not have enough money to buy what they need. 40% of Egyptians now survive on less than $1 a day. Ish is the Egyptian Arabic word for both bread and life. And that is what is at issue here with the control of finance policy, of economic policy, of trade policy, of investment policy, of decisions about where the effort and energy and labor and value of our production is to be applied on a global scale. The monster of hunger is what Germany's finance minister, Peer Steinbrück, had described it, and he said it is looming on the world political stage. That comes back to who rules, who has control, what institutions, what system, what economic order determines these things. It's corporate capitalism, it's banking capital, it's the capitalist order itself.
I want to thank all of you who telephoned today, and we'll be doing this again. But meanwhile, I want to announce that during the WBAI Fund Drive, where our premium is going to be the four-part series about Bear Stearns and the crisis of capitalism, it'll be edited, and it'll be a four-CD presentation. Next Tuesday, for our first foray into the WBAI Fund Drive, we're going to be on 2 hours. The first hour in the morning, following Democracy Now, 11 to 12 on the East Coast, that's 8 to 9 a.m. in the West, on the West Coast, and check your time zone throughout the world. Then we'll be on again during the regular Taking Aim slot Tuesday from 5 to 6. So we're going to have a lot of discussion next Tuesday about the crisis of capitalism. I'm sure you're going to appreciate it, and we hope that you contribute all you can to the WBAI Fund Drive. Remember, this is listener-sponsored. This is your radio station. And tomorrow when the Fund Drive starts, we hope that, again, you're going to enjoy all the special programming and especially to look forward to Taking Aim next week. Again, our website is www.takingaimradio.com. And our email address is takingaim@pacbell, that's P-A-C-B-E-L-L .net. And when you write to us, we will respond. So please send us your comments and your questions. It's been a pleasure discussing with each and every one of you. We look forward to it again.
Let me mention one thing before we close. When we spoke at St. Mark's Church last week, the day after we were speaking at an event for Lynn Stewart on May Day, and I mentioned that in particular because the struggle goes on, brothers and sisters, and those who are in the forefront of it by Lynn Stewart are targeted by the state. So it concentrates our issues and our concerns. Stand firm with Lynn Stewart. Stand firm with the struggle and the fight back, because repression is the answer of a decadent system. We must resist it when it occurs and overcome it if we are to prevail.
And, Ralph, let's mention again, go to ny911truth.org, download the petition, distribute the petition, and let's have a real citizens investigation. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We'll be with you next week. We'll be right back.
look in the eye. Sa-tum-sa, chin-da-sa-do, sa-tum-sa. Feel a lot.